Welcome to Chewing a Yak with Chris Champagne, my New Orleans interview show on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans. Today, by special guest, it's great pianist Tom McDermott. Thanks, Tom, for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. What you up to today?
Well, I'm interviewing one of New Orleans' finest piano players. That's what I'm doing. We've become kind of friendly. We've hang out in the same spot sometimes.
Yes, we do.
So we see each other and kind of catch up. And what are you up to? I know you're up to, one thing you're up to is you're doing a new album. We talked about that yesterday.
Yeah, I am recording an album of Scott Joplin rags, which is kind of like going back to the beginning of my playing career. After 7 years of piano lessons, I could play the piano, but I didn't really have a direction. And discovering Scott Joplin's music when I was about 14 was a big, was really the start of what I have become, whatever that is. That is, early jazz and New Orleans R&B and Brazilian music and Cuban music. But Scott Joplin was the entree into all that because his music is a link between classical music and jazz in a way, as is all of ragtime.
Well, when people ask me, to describe what I do, it's kind of difficult, and you just mentioned it. I mean, you can play so many different styles, and you do. So is there a way to describe you that people must ask you that question as well?
Well, of course, I'm a pianist, and the golden age of piano music has been pretty much, with some exceptions, pre-World War II. So I'm interested in older traditional styles, ragtime, early jazz. I love the Brazilian and Cuban music from that time, too. I like this French valse musette tradition. I love the classical piano repertoire from, especially the 19th century, Chopin and Beethoven, Albéniz, people like that. And I have dabbled in my life in other art forms. I was a music critic for 3 years for the St. Louis Globe Democrat as a stringer, however, not as a full-time member of the staff. So that was, it paid painfully low, and I eventually abandoned that and moved to New Orleans and became a full-time musician. I've also done a bit of artwork in my time. I was got my undergraduate degree in art, and when I'm in shape, I can draw pretty well.
Well, speaking of which, we're going to talk about your book, your limerick book, in a little bit, and read a few for us if you don't mind. But the name of the book is Five Lines, No Waiting. Is that correct?
That's it.
And it's been out for how long?
Well, when did this come out? 2 years ago or just 1 year? 2017, so it's just last spring it came out.
Well, when your name comes up in conversation sometimes, I'll tell people that we're friends and I'll mention the book to them. And a lot of people are surprised that you have the book, so we're going to talk about the book in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit more about the music, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Well, when I hear you speak about music, you have a great knowledge of it, but you also have, it seems, a reverence for just music in general. So you seek out all kinds.
Yes. I have tried to make a point of really surveying various areas of music. That takes a lot of time. So when I was in my 20s, I made surveys of classical music and jazz. I went through and heard all the big names that I could. It was harder then. You had to go out and buy records, or borrow records from the library, which I did a lot of that. And I went as far back as medieval music. Actually, I got a master's degree in music, so I studied some of that when I did that. And I've tried to absorb as much 20th century classical music this is just one type of music. Then with jazz, or in a broader sense African-American music, I've tried to go back to ragtime up to I'm not a huge, I just don't know the world of hip hop and rap, and I hope I'm not putting it down when I say this, but I just don't feel like it's my world exactly. Yeah. Like my concerns with music are other things than it's not made for me. So, sure. And I accept that, you know, that's just the way it is. But now, for instance, I'm going back, and I was, you know, kind of a snooty kid learning my Chopin and my Joplin, and I didn't pay attention to 60s and 70s pop music. So I've been going through and posting on Facebook, you know, I'm listening to Harry Nilsson, first 8 albums, and I like to do that. Now you can do that with YouTube, or even just buy the records cheaply. You can listen to the first 5 albums very easily, and so I'm doing that with various people who I just never, you know, listened to because I was too busy playing the piano and adoring, you know, Chopin and Beethoven and Joplin, etc.
So. Well, you know, you look at your bio, you have kind of an eclectic list of things that you like, from Chopin, like you say, to the Beatles, to Frank Sinatra, to Brazilian music.
Yeah.
So is there but you just talked about how you've been exploring the 60s and 70s that maybe you kind of like glossed over at that time because of other interests. Is there anything that you've discovered, if you can use that word?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and once again, it's often a case of, okay, I'll listen to these people, and I remember I went to Costa Rica, and for some weird reason, the people I was staying with had a good record collection of American music, and I listened to the first and the third Doors album, and I had never done that. All I'd heard was Light My Fire and a couple other things, and I didn't get the Doors at all. But then when I heard those albums, I said, oh, now I get it. You know, they were truly doing something different than all the Beatles imitators were doing. And now, do I sit around and listen to the Doors? No, I don't. But I understand. I understand why people loved them at the time and why they still may love them, you know. I just had a revelation about, you know, Janis Joplin, who I always kind of dismissed as, you know, a shrieker. But in fact, I heard a track called Turtle Blues. It's on the Cheap Thrills album, and it's just her and a piano, and she like does one scream at the beginning, and the rest is like hardcore great blues singing. And then I listen to other tracks, and it's like, wow, you know, she really was good. And I'm having this type of revelation over and over with music of the 60s and 70s, at least. I think when it gets into the 80s, for me, I don't know, something happens. Disco did a lot of damage. The corporate conglomeration of, you know, I don't know. It's just, you know, drum machines and synthetic everything just changed the music to my ears. But, you know, for somebody who grew up with that, it's a different experience.
Right. Well, it's kind of like if you grew up with something, you kind of have an affinity for it, usually.
Especially with music. Yeah. I found that, for instance, you know, boomers can go back and watch, you know, episodes of Gilligan's Island that they loved when they were kids, and they can see that this is crap. You know, this is really, really, really stupid. On the other hand, they cannot admit to themselves that the Monkees was crap, you know, because music penetrates you in a different way. It has an emotional attachment to you. You know, I didn't listen to the Monkees when I was a kid, so I can listen to it and say, this is crap, you know, but people who did think it's fantastic stuff, you know, even today, even though they can be convinced that, oh, you know, Laugh-In is horrible, or Gilligan's Island, all this dreck that was shoveled down our throats when we were kids, you know, on TV. with few exceptions. You know, there was some good TV too, but most of it was horrible. You know,
well, you know, it's kind of like a bonding thing. I mean, it's like if you meet someone from the smallest remote village of any culture, and they end up being, you know, in a modern world, you know, you always have this emotional fond attachment, even if it was a horrible place. I mean, as far as like, you know, being deprived of things. So it's kind of, you just get used to it. It's like being bonded to you as like a baby duck or something, perhaps. I mean, it's something that you enjoyed just for itself. And sometimes you just don't go beyond that. And you don't have to. I mean, if you enjoy it or you appreciate it.
Yeah. I still insist music is different. I mean, if you read a Hardy Boys book now, you know, I read those when I was a kid, you'd realize how this is for 5, 10-year-olds,
right,
or whatever.
Well, I would agree with that to this extent. I mean, you're much more versed in music way than I am. But for instance, I'll listen to like an oldie station, and they'll play a variety of oldies from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever. And I'll look back at my era, and I'll think to myself, man, this song is horrible. I don't want to hear this song.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
But there'll be a few that I think are still good. And from every era, with me, that's the same. In other words, every era there were a few that I really like and then have legs, for lack of a better word. So over time, you said to myself, man, how can people like that? But they do, because they replay it.
Yeah,
all the time. And I guess somebody must like it, or they wouldn't play it. I was listening. Couldn't sleep the other night, and I was put on an oldie station, and they had a six pack, you know, six songs of greatest rock and roll hits of all time. And and these were the worst six songs in a row I've ever heard in my life. I'm thinking to myself, how could somebody pick six songs like this so bad in a row?
It's because they heard it when they were 12 years old, and it really connected in a way that a piece of writing or a piece of art or would not. I don't know why it is. It's because music ties to the brain and to the heart a different way than the other arts.
Yeah, probably so. I think that's probably true. So you become over time a aficionado of Brazilian music.
Yes, I certainly know it, and I have put out an album that I like a lot, recorded down in Brazil. That was, you know, now 13 years ago.
Wow, man.
And I still play some of the choros with various people around town. This early music that's kind of the equivalent of our rag or trad jazz. There are other people in town who play it better than I, certainly. But it has a big part of my heart, because that was another thing. After discovering Scott Joplin, I think that the next big important thing in the developing my aesthetic was going to Brazil repeatedly, starting in 2000. I've been 17 times now, and what I really loved was the fact that there's musicians down there, they're playing these choros and these sambas, which are now, like, these choros are 19th century pieces, some of them, and these samba begins being recorded in 1917, so they're playing sambas from the 20s and 30s, and, you know, modern versions of each too. But if you're these guys who are playing this 19th century music and playing it straight are not being dismissed as, you know, cornballs, like ragtimers would be today, you know, they're instead considered, oh, you know, arbiters of our great national heritage, you know, let's salute them for having learned this music and presenting it to us. You know, quite the difference from you know, anything today that's before, you know, 1950 or whatever.
Cultures are different. That's what I was going to ask you. That also, you travel extensively. I have, and
when I saw that, it made me realize, okay, yeah, you know, I don't have to play, you know, more modern jazz that I don't have much feel for and don't understand. And, you know, even though that's what you're supposed to play as a jazz guy and to be considered hip or whatever, I don't have to do that. I can, you know, play this older music and feel okay, that there's nothing wrong with that, because I've seen it. I've seen it in Cuba. I've seen it in Brazil, you know, people doing just that. People taking this older music and then playing it in a different style, which I like to do as well. I like to take older forms and play them my own way. And that's not always the case with, say, traditional jazz. You know, some people don't like you to mess around with the form or, you know, put in more modern notes or whatever. But that's what I like to do. So.
Well, then you should do that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've got some skins on a wall now. I mean, you're a well-known player now, so you can kind of do things like that.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. without retribution or whatever happens to someone who does such things. But I was going to ask you, you've been around the world quite a bit, and I wanted to ask you how are you received when you go to these places? Are you welcomed as a New Orleans musician, or are you just as a musician? What do you think more?
Well, the New Orleans brand is definitely a factor, and even though I wasn't born in New Orleans, I have been here 34 years, and I've tried to learn it. You know, there's still a bit of, like, occasionally I get the you weren't born here thing, but not too often. Here I get that. I don't get that
anyplace else.
So, no, I have to be very thankful. If I had not moved to New Orleans and had done exactly what I've done in St. Louis, I would not have it anywhere near as wide-ranging a career as I've had. It's, you know, people come to New Orleans to hear New Orleans music, and then they allow them to export themselves, you know. There are New Orleans music festivals in France and in Switzerland and New Orleans and San Francisco and, you know, probably many other places that I can't name right now, so...
Well, do you find the European audiences, for instance, they're more seeking out traditional jazz than, say, an American audience in general?
That certainly used to be the case.
Yeah, that's why, yeah.
And it may still be the case in places like, I don't know, Germany and Switzerland. I've seen it sort of ebb in Copenhagen, where I've spent a lot of time, and I think it has to do with just the audience has just gotten old, you know.
Yeah.
That's a real problem.
Well, that's true. I wonder about that sometimes, about, you know, the core of like we were talking before, the time when that music was popular, those people have kind of gone little by little.
Yes, it's a... Definitely. I mean, even when I play house concerts on the road, it's typically an older, it's a boomer or boomer plus audience. And I'm fine with that. You know, I hope another 20 years of playing, and I hope that the boomers will stick around with me and absorb my music. But you know, when I go on the road and play a solo concert, I don't really even play comfort music that people would know. I kind of give a little... I try and tie in, like, Gottschalk and Cuba and Jelly Roll Morton and later jazz and then Brazilian music and show the links between these musics, you know, by... like playing a rag as a Brazilian in a Brazilian style, or playing, showing the connections between Gottschalk and Cuba. Gottschalk was, for your listeners, a 19th century New Orleanian who was first guy to really mix, first guy to write down, shall we say, African rhythms with European harmony and such. It was. To an extent that we would listen to it today. Now, the first example of that, of the Cuban rhythms being written down, goes back 50 years before Gottschalk. But I don't know who that composer was. Gottschalk was the first guy to really create a mass of music. And then he influenced a couple generations. And then he pretty much has been forgotten, except for, you know, among, you know, the arts crowd, as
yeah.
I would call it.
I was going to ask you, when you came down here, how much Gottschalk was discussed or even considered?
You know, that's a good question. I don't remember specifically when I discovered him, if it was... It was probably after I got down here. I don't remember. I could tell you the first Gottschalk albums I heard, but he is more popular now, but he's still not still not a household name. Strange, you know, somebody who is more popular now definitely is James Booker. And I think a lot of it has to do with Lily Kieber's movie. And just 35 years of people beating the drum for Booker, but Harry Connick Jr., among them, George Winston. But Lily's Kieber's movie, Bayou Maharaja, I know has exposed probably thousands of people to Booker's music by now.
It's pretty good. It's a really good movie. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. If people don't know about him, it's probably a revelation.
Yeah.
I mean, for people who are interested in music.
Right.
And did he have any influence on you coming down here? That's what I read.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was a perfect storm of things collapsing in St. Louis. my gig as the jazz rock critic ended because the paper went out of business. And I had a girlfriend who really wanted me out of the house. And there was that. And I got a gig at the World's Fair in '84 as a St. Louisan, which is kind of amazing when I think of it. You know, how did I just happened to have a connection. A guy who lived in St. Louis who was connected to New Orleans and connected to the people who booked the music. And that's just so unlikely. I just have to think it was fate that I would come down here.
Well, that's how things happen often. Just you happen to know someone.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I don't mean it in a way like, you know, like it's like you're a Rockefeller. Just in your normal course of events,
true.
Just having
friends
who know about something that you wouldn't have known about otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get your gigs from reading the want ads. You get it from other musicians.
Yeah.
You know, that's why networking is so important. Going and sitting in, and you got to do that, especially when you move to a town. And that's why it's so hard to start over. I mean, because it takes years to build that up. Usually, not always.
Well, speaking of gigs, what regular gigs do you have as we're speaking now?
Right. At this point, I only have two steady gigs, but I've had them for 8 years. They are Bufas on Thursdays. And for much of that time, I've played with Aurora Nealand. But Aurora travels a lot, so I've used many other people. And right before that, on Thursday, I've been playing at Three Muses for about 8 years. I recently, earlier this year, lost a wonderful gig with Mashiach Lake that was also another 8-year gig at Chickiwawa. She moved to Ireland. So at this point, I only have two, but I have a once or twice a month gig at a Bywater Bakery, which is a really lovely little place at Independence and Dauphine, in about 8 blocks from Poland, from the end of the upper Ninth Ward, if we would say that. And you know, I play Snug Harbor once every couple months. I just get, you know, casuals a lot. You know, I play at Houston's once in a while. I play at,
Well, you're all over. They can find you on LiveWire, and you have a website that they could follow you on.
Well,
you don't have to.
McDermottmusic.com, but I don't really keep it up.
Yeah.
But In fact, I got to. I got to change that because I haven't, since I lost the Mashiach gig, I have not altered that. But I'm happy to have my two Thursday gigs because that's a good chunk of money for one day. And if I want, I can travel Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday now.
Yeah. That's a good deal.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, listen, you could talk about music, I'm sure, for hours and hours. But let's talk a little bit about the book, the Five Lines, No Waiting, the Limerick book that you did. How did it come about?
And, well, I started writing limericks on Facebook, and at one point I posted that, hey, you know, I think I've written about 60 good ones, and when I get to 100, I'm gonna self-publish. And a guy named Jacob Smolian, who owns Sagging Meniscus Press, he wrote in and said, hey, don't do that. I love your limericks. I'll publish them. But he had also seen my drawings, because I'd posted them earlier. Yeah. He said, I'll do them if you use your drawings too. And so he put out, he has a little, what he called sagging shorts, a little short, you know, little, these are very small books. In fact, this one is so small, I'm putting out a second edition of it that'll be about twice as big, oh, I hope.
Okay. When's the dust coming out?
I hope by Jazz Fest next year.
Okay.
And because this is almost pamphlet size, although people don't seem to mind. But I want to do it and have better drawings. And then some of these I cranked out about 30 in the last month, and some of them I don't think are that good. So I've had time in the last year to write about another 100. So about probably 25 of those are good enough. And then I hope to just keep, I need 40 or 50 more with some drawings. And, you know.
Why don't you read us a couple, if you don't mind?
Oh, sure.
I think the drawings are really great, actually. Yeah.
Well, you know, I did get my degree in art, so
I can't draw with a damn, so I admire that as well. But
here's one. You don't have to be an old limey to learn to use words like, oh, blimey. Brit talk is fun, and when you are done, you'll sling a slang less five and dimey. You know, they limericks are typically dirty, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to explore other modes of other emotions. So here's one, which has a pretty good drawing attached. How awkward to sit on a jet with people whom you've never met. You try to make chat, they'll have none of that. You leave with a pang of regret. And I think everybody has had that.
Yeah,
experience.
I'm sure it's true.
And how about one more?
Sure.
Let's see. Whenever the saints fall apart, it breaks the Orleanian heart. We feel bereft, because all we got left is music and eating and art.
That's a good one.
And very true.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I cover, you know.
What, do you bring them to your gigs usually?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah,
because I only have like 8 copies left.
Okay.
And I'm just going to wait till I put out this next edition and start selling.
But if somebody wants to get them, are they on Amazon?
Yeah, I guess
it's
they are.
Lines, no waiting, right?
I guess they are. And I guess they're on the sagmeniscus.com website, although he doesn't have many copies either. Okay. So yeah. We're just waiting, and it's like, it's not urgent like CDs, although books, are, as you know, are being devalued as well, but at a much slower pace, and people are always going to buy books. I'm convinced.
I think that's
of that.
True. You have it in your hand.
Yeah. And whereas, you know, CDs, yeah, at some point, you
can sit under a tree and read it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I think books will never disappear. They've just been around for too long, where CDs have not been around that long.
I guess that's true, but it's just, it's a little bit of a different physical operation.
Yeah.
So, we're going to, if you don't mind, we're going to travel over to the piano. You play a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So you choose what you'd like to play.
Well, let me play, since this is for a New Orleans audience, I can play a bit of, say, Tipitina. How's that sound?
Sitting here, before we get to another song, if you'll be kind enough to play us another one, I was just sitting here at the piano, and I was wondering, since you have a degree in history, I mean music history, or music, when was the piano actually invented? I mean, as we know it today, I mean, more or less.
Well, it was a slow evolution to switch from something like the clavichord or the harpsichord, which had a keyboard but had a different method of creating sound. Like harpsichord, the string is actually plucked. Clavichord, I'm not sure what happens with that, but it doesn't have the piano type action. The piano is a hammer hitting a string. It took a long time from the first piano, which had a much shorter keyboard, to develop to the 88 key keyboard, and really wasn't in place. Like even Beethoven did not have a full 88 keys. Chopin, no, I don't even believe he did. It wasn't until after them that you have something approaching the modern piano, which is, I don't know, the 1860s, 70s, something like that.
It just seems like the whole concept of it is just so, I don't know. Something about it, just to me, just looking at it as a non-musician, I mean, it took a lot of thought to go into this.
Oh, yeah, it took hundreds of years from the first keyboard instruments and to the grand piano we know today.
And would you consider what it's given to us?
Yeah, and it's, 10,000 parts in this thing.
Yeah,
so.
Right. It's quite a human invention.
Yeah, really.
We talked about the Brazilian music before. Could you give us an example of that?
Sure. I'll play a piece called Escorregando. It's about 4 minutes long.
Sure, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
This is by a fellow named Ernesto Nazare. It's spelled like Nazareth, but it's pronounced Nazare. And he was sort of the Scott Joplin figure of his era. That is, he was not black. He was a mix of white and Indian, but he combined the influences of Africa and Europe. He creolized the European dance music to help create this new music. In his case, beginnings of Choro.
Stuff there.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Well, that was some choro music led by Tom McDermott. This is Chris Champagne. We're on Chewing the Yacht, WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans. And we've been joined today by Tom McDermott. Thanks a lot. We have a few more minutes, so we're not through yet, but I just wanted to throw that in. I'm kind of new at this radio stuff, and I have to let them know what they're listening to occasionally here. Is there a song that If you're someplace where people are requesting music, is there a song that someone requests and you're always really happy when they request that, a particular song, maybe, that you can think of? Something that you really enjoy playing?
Well, I like it when people ask for Brazilian music or Booker. It's just it's good to be associated with Booker.
Right.
I've really put... At one time, I was just so crazy about his music. He's still my favorite pianist ever, I would say. But I was just so deeply into him it was mania, you know. And eventually I stopped like trying to learn his pieces as he played them, because you're never going to be as good. You just can't simulate his touch. And then I just took like ideas from him, especially his left hand. This one particular left hand, and I started applying them to 60s pop tunes that wouldn't sound very good with other left hands. And it's been fun. I like just today I played at a gig a Beatles tune From Me to You, huh? With this Booker style. Beatles as a kid, unlike most of the pop music of the time, and I so appreciate them these days as a working musician, because oftentimes I'm in a room and, you know, there might be 20 or 30 year olds who really don't even, they've never seen a piano player, really, hardly. I mean, it's like they don't understand the idea that, you know, I'm pressing a key and it's hitting a string, and, you know, I think it's just, I know I've met like 9 year olds who have never seen a piano or just like gawking, like, anyway, you know, there's not much piano music out there for them to even listen to, you know, that Alicia Keys, Ben Folds Five, I don't know who else is out there. It's just like, in any case, hopefully they know the Beatles, and oftentimes they do. And I know the Beatles album One, which was their greatest hits, most recent greatest hits package, was at one time the best-selling album of the new millennium. Okay. So
that's interesting. Yeah,
yeah, it's good to know. So, you know, any boomers that have, all the boomers love Beatles music, so hopefully they pass it on to their kids. And usually, you know, so usually if I want to get their attention, I'll play a Beatles tune, or I'll play, you know, that's on TV. You know, what they know is on TV. You know.
So. Well, that's true. It was the same for us, but I guess when we were young too. I mean, you know, in fact, our world was more narrow because we had fewer channels.
Yeah.
You know, now they at least they have, you know, more things to be exposed to, I suppose,
in your general life. But you know, the
radio was wider back then.
Right? Yeah, probably so.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. So,
well, collateral damage, I guess, from the popularity of hip hop is musical instruments.
I suppose.
I mean, some of it. I mean, it's not quite as.
You know, that's not to say there isn't robust, interest in, Americana music.
Well, sure.
Roots music. It's thriving. It's just not the top 40. Which brings me to another concern I have, and that is that there are no New Orleans new standards being created. It kind of died with Alan Toussaint in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing, even Harry Connick and Wynton Marsalis, who were like at the top of the heap, I guess Wynton maybe still is in jazz, and you know, they could not create a standard that is going to be played 50 years from now. It appears, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you need to get busy, Tom.
Yeah, well, I don't have access to that. I mean, and they're both fine composers. And Harry's written some good stuff, but none of it is, it's worrisome, because what is New Orleans music that's new? I mean, what is it always going to be Little Liza Jane and Heidi 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 Ho, which isn't even New Orleans music, but it just bothers me.
Well, I don't know how to answer that. That's an interesting observation for sure.
Yeah.
Listen, before I forget, obviously you have some CDs. How can people get your CDs if they want to get them?
Music Factory.
Okay.
That's what I prefer.
Okay.
I sell them on gigs too.
Sure.
And some of them are on Amazon. I don't know how much control I have over that.
Right. Yeah. So Music Factory is the best place, or at your gigs.
Yeah.
Okay. Just popped into my mind, do you, since I'm a comedian, I'm supposed to be, what do you think when you see Chico Marx playing the piano?
Well, it's, it's showbiz.
Yeah.
I don't think he was a great pianist.
Yeah.
But he can do this. This is a thing where he... pretended like he was... Now, Harpo was a real harpist, for sure.
Yeah.
But Chico, he got by. He even led an orchestra for a while.
Yeah, that's true. Well, he was a star, though. He was a movie star. So that's why. Grubbs could play the guitar, but they didn't use that shtick too much in the...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He plays it in, Go West, I think he plays it.
Ah.
Yeah.
Dang.
I mean, he didn't get down or anything, but, you know.
He could play chords.
Yeah.
Oh, I never knew that.
Well, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, they probably taught them all to play something, because the mom, the showbiz.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Just like the Boswells.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There's lots of New Orleans
back music then history. Back then, you had to sing, you had to dance, you had to...
Yeah,
had to do it all.
Yeah, a lot of those people who we know from films and different music in those days. I mean, they could do a lot of things. They could dance and sing and play musical instruments, and the whole shtick.
Yeah.
Generally, they wanted to be in showbiz. Well, I think we have a little bit more time. You want to give us? Would you give us another tune?
Sure.
Thanks so much for being here as well with me. I appreciate it.
I'll just give you a little Maple Leaf Rag about
okay.
that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Today we've been talking to Tom McDermott, New Orleans' great pianist, and we listen to Chewing the Yak on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans, and I'm Chris Champagne. And you can catch Tom at on Thursdays at Buffa's and Three Muses, right?
That's correct.
And all around town other days, too. Just check it out. And thanks again, Tom.
Thank you, Chris.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Okay.
So when will that air?
Next week, next Wednesday.
Okay.
At 5 o'clock. I'll let you know, and I'll also send you the podcast, too, on the email.
Oh, okay. So who have you, how many of these have you done so far?
This is, I think, my 9th one.
Oh.
So
Who else that I would know?
Well, let's see. Well, James Singleton was on the first one.
Oh, great.
He was talking because he had a gig that night, the first show I was on, so I had him on. And let's see, I had Cheryl Gerber.
Oh, okay.
Photographer.
Oh, is she talking about Esplanade Avenue? And...
Well, not too much. We talked about her career as a photographer.
Yeah.
And I've known her for so long. You know, I knew her mom, actually, back in Mandeville. Her mom was a poet.
Oh, okay.
You know, and
we're about the same age, I guess.